If we can just find a solution for this problem in the next hour, we will be heroes all over the state. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel, and thank you for being willing to help us take a good close look at rural sanitation today. Yes, the bush is in the spotlight. Our phone number, 1-800-478-8255, to join the conversation toll-free. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talkatalaskapublic.org. Biospherian Mark Nelson was on the show not long ago talking about the feces sphere, and that discussion continues today on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
I've never been known for wanting to do shows about hopeless situations and having everybody hand-wringing all the time. It just seems like there's no point in it. I'd like to have a conversation, and so if we can talk about solutions, that's what I'm all about. But certainly this is a major issue in the state of Alaska. It's an issue that's soaked up hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. And it's not all that easy to talk about. They use euphemisms, sanitation. They talk about water and public health. But it's really just a matter of dealing with human waste in villages in Alaska. And how can we accomplish this? When we have a paradigm, we have a paradigm nationally. It's been set years ago that it's the most sanitary thing is to have flush toilets. So it's almost as if people feel they have a right to a flush toilet. And as Mark Nelson told us on our earlier program on this issue, is this really the best use of our water? I don't know. Well, I do know. But what do you think? 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. We were asked to approach this program by Jocelyn Estes, the news director of KNBA, our member station in Anchorage, and she's running a thrust? I don't know, what do you call it? Kick the bucket.
Yeah, kick the bucket. So I applied for a fellowship with the University of Southern California Annenberg School of Journalism and the Dennis Hunt Foundation. And the story that I pitched to them was about rural sanitation. And they gave me a small stipend to travel to one or two villages, and I went to Kivalina. But when I went down there, I mean, I think anybody who's lived in Alaska for very long knows that rural, you know, there are dozens of villages that don't have running water and flush toilets. And if you look back on the great achievements of public health, clean water is one of the most fundamental. It's one of the most basic things that help people stay healthy. So, but we're so used to it here. So when I went down to the fact that dozens of villages don't have it and don't have flush toilets, so it was kind of an eye-opener to me when I went down to this fellowship at USC. They had some classes for us on health, and I started telling people about our situation here, and they were shocked and appalled. They couldn't believe it, that this is still going on in Alaska, and especially when they hear about how wealthy the state has been for so long. Because a lot of the other reporters came from states and cities that have been struggling. You know, they really were hurt by the recession.
But that doesn't mean they're going to shut off the sewer and water.
Right.
No,
yeah.
I don't think so.
And so I'm really glad that I happened on this topic, and I'm really interested in hearing what people have to say today.
Good. Well, I'm glad you could come in and sit at the microphone. And we do have a panel as well as expecting your calls at 1-800-478-8255. I'm really happy that Bill Griffith is with us at the Department of Environmental Conservation. He runs the Alaska Village Safe Water Program. Bill, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
And what does your job consist of? Setting priorities, handing out money? What do you do?
Yeah, well, I manage a program called Facility Programs, which includes capital projects and funding. So we get involved in those kinds of decisions. And then in addition, we provide technical assistance. So that means that we provide funding for programs like the Remote Maintenance Worker Program that's out trying to assist operators and managers to run their existing systems.
You know, that is one of the first. Can you give me some idea of what the magnitude of the maintenance situation with existing systems is, the scale of it?
Well, a maintenance as in just day-to-day operation?
Yeah, and stuff that, you know, there's going to be stuff as it gets old, it don't mm-hmm. work so well.
Exactly. So we've got, a couple of hundred systems out there in villages. And many of those systems have long surpassed their design life of, let's say, 30 years or so.
30 years sounds like a long time on the front end of it.
Yeah, but at the back end, it begins to look a little bit ragged. And so a lot of those systems are either undersized or not meeting current regulation or just plain worn out by old materials. And the estimated cost to get those systems all upgraded and up to where we think they need to be just to meet current health needs is roughly $400 million or so. Mm-hmm. So what you're talking about day-to-day for the operators of those systems is trying to just keep those older systems that are in need of upgrades just operational and running throughout some pretty harsh conditions.
And then there's the question of places that simply don't have such systems yet.
Exactly. So we've got another 30 or so communities that don't have running water and sewer to individual homes. And those communities have some kind of system as well, typically what we call a washateria, which is a combined water treatment plant along with a place to do laundry and take showers. So they've got that those very minimal facilities, but
no service to homes. Yeah, that's sort of like the first step in a way. And we're also, when we talked with AVEC, this is, they can better distribute power loads if they get the washateria and maybe community buildings and so forth integrated in there. It allows for better load management. So that's the beginning. So in other words, you don't have much of a network. It's all really stuck in one place.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So the washateria then would have what sort of system would be a disposable system? Disposal system, it does a treatment of some sort, and then there's an effluent and a sludge, or how does it work?
Yeah, well, there's typically a water plant in the building that provides water for the laundry and the showers, and then there's toilets there as well. And then there's typically a community watering point where people can come and get water that's safe to drink.
Mm-hmm. So that's, and then it's meeting health. Supposedly meeting public health standards and I guess all that sort of thing.
Sure, sure. Very, very minimal services at just a very basic level, but no service to individual homes in those communities.
Mm-hmm. But by having a system that is so small, obviously you have less problems with insulating the system. You have, tobacco issues, permafrost issues, and so forth will be somewhat minimized.
Somewhat minimized, but you may still have sewer lines between that facility and a lagoon, or you could have water lines between the water source and the treatment plant. So you may still have pipes, but very minimal.
Yeah. Well, now, lagoons, I know, are a problem in Alaska. I mean, maybe water's supposed to be treated before it gets there, but often isn't. But in many cases, honey buckets are simply dumped, and children go play by the lagoon.
Yeah, villages in Alaska rely almost exclusively on some kind of a sewage lagoon for treatment and disposal. And that's true whether or not they have pipes or whether they have honey buckets. But they become a real challenge when they are honey bucket lagoons, because not only do you have sewage going in there, but you got bags and all kinds of other waste from the household that ends up there.
Hmm. Let's go to Herman, joins the program from ANIAC, and our phone number is 1-800-478-8255. We're particularly keen to to hear from rural Alaskans and their personal situations that they want to talk about. That's why Jocelyn wanted to put this on statewide so that we could just get a little bit of reality check like you did when we went out to the village there. So let's go to Herman, joins the program from Aniak. Good to have you back on, Herman.
Yeah, good morning, boy. I called so much I was having my own show, maybe. But anyhow, I was going to tell you, I work for the Mid-Yukon Kuskokwim Soil and Water Conservation District, and this happened to be right down along the line of one study we're doing. It's a common practice for these sewage lagoons to be pumped into the river. You know, they say it's treated, but they pump the top of the water sometimes for a week or a couple of weeks right into the river, you know. And we're doing a study to see if that sewage has any effect on, like, salmon or any other aquatic species. And we were able to collect some sockeye salmon smolt that were present in the river, you know. And, you know, people will say that, gee, that's only one fish. But if you think about it, that one fish can lay about over maybe a couple thousand eggs, you know. And there's another area where it was being done, they're finding out that these salmon are deformed. One salmon, it's both male and female. They cut them open, they have both egg sacs and sperm sacs. And they find out it's from the hormones that are from birth control pills, you know. When a woman goes to the bathroom, it's still working. And it's affecting those salmon to be deformed, you know. And it seems like there should be another practice than pumping the sewage lagoon into the river. A lot of them are leaking. And there's another problem. You heard of bird flu, you know, and in one community there's about 70 ducks living and raising their young right in that sewage lagoon. And you know how many eggs they lay. And around some of them lagoons, them blackfish, they're normally 3 or 4 inches long, but they're growing as big as cucumbers. So, and one community, they're saying a lot of people, they weren't paying their sewer bills, you know, so their commodities being shut off, you know, they're back using honey buckets, you know. And some of them were saying, gee, you know, a long time ago we used to have outhouses where our waste was buried, you know, and that kept it away from the river. So I think something needs to be done other than using these sewage lagoons that might be hurting our environment. Our funding has been cut quite a bit for soil and water conservation districts, so but I hope we get refunded. But that's one of the things we're doing. That seems needs to be treated, you know, or other way than having it affecting our environment in those ways, especially our salmon current crisis right now. And those are my comments.
Herman, thank you very much. That's certainly a lot. And I don't, you know, it. I wish I could say, wow, that sounds like a nightmare of exaggeration here, but I don't think it is. I don't think it is that much of an exaggeration because, you know, some of the stuff I've seen myself, and you're just telling us from experience and from your watershed assessment. So I want to thank you very much for your call, Herman. It's Talk of Alaska, 1-800-478-8255. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email is talk@alaskapublic.org. And I think before we go to our next caller from Nikiski, let's bring in Bob White of the Yukon Kuskokwim Health Corporation, Office of Environmental Health. Bob, how you doing?
I'm doing good. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I wonder if you just have any observations and if you can back up what Herman's already told us from Aniak there.
Well, you know, sewer lagoons are an interesting problem, one we deal with regularly. With my technical assistance that I do with villages, we have to pump as those lagoons reach height. If we let them flow over, we risk having the dam break and all the sewage flow uncontrolled. But there are concerns. You know, anytime we're pumping effluent, we're hopefully have reached the treatment goals, but there's definitely some research to be done in treatment, especially with pharmaceuticals. It's a raising problem across the nation where sewage hasn't been traditionally tested for it to see what the effects are of those things as they flow out into the environment around.
Yeah, and that's expensive testing, too. That's like big mass spec and everything.
Well, the other thing about this, though, is that are there people downriver who might be drawing water from the river? Because when I was out in Kivalina, they
have. I believe the answer to that is yes.
Yeah. So if they're dumping, if they're emptying sewage lagoons into the river, how's that affecting people downriver?
Well, there are some standards, I believe. But there are standards.
Yes, there are effluent standards for those lagoons, and there typically is testing going on while they're pumping lagoons.
Right. But the fact of the matter is, our science has evolved. And I went to a meeting where they were talking about tranquilizers. People take tranquilizers. The tranquilizers don't just stay in people's systems. They go right back out. They end up in the water. They affect the fish. And the fish act differently because of the human tranquilizers. they don't know exactly whether it's good or bad, but it would seem bad to me if the fish are mellowed out and they're trying to escape predators. It might not be such a good thing. So, yeah, well, we're getting down to this, the situation I was afraid we'd get into, which is the hand-wringing, which is, what a bad situation. And then, oh, well, you think that's bad? Wait till you hear this. But, I'm going to call on you, Bill Griffith at DEC, to see if you have done any examination of what we might look to for newer technologies, perhaps, that don't use water or use water in a different way or something.
There are a few things going on to try to deal with the problem, I think, in a non-traditional way. I should probably mention that Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium has a pilot project going on in Kivalina that Jacqueline visited to try to look at ways of using a lot less water in the home and getting water from traditional sources like rainwater.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one project that they've got going on. The state of Alaska has another project called the Alaska Water and Sewer Challenge, where we've got a competition going on among teams from all over the place, kind of multidisciplinary teams. And these teams are in competition to see what they can come up with for what we call a decentralized or a household system. So looking at how you might be able to utilize water and sewer in a home that doesn't rely on a centralized system the way that we've traditionally have. And we're hopeful that we can come up with some better solutions. We think there are technologies available now that just haven't been put together in a way that'll work for rural Alaska households.
This would seem like one of those situations where it would be, we might need to reach out to the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. To Iceland and, I don't know, Norway, Russia, other northern places that with all the modern electronic communication that we have these days, maybe we need to look for success stories.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have begun to do that. We've had some conferences over recent years. We've invited people from places like Greenland and Norway and Canada, of course, and taken a look at what they've done. They do some different things that aren't necessarily available to us because we have, let's say, different regulations. We've got different approaches in terms of funding from the federal government that make it possible to do things in other countries that we're not able to do right now. But the technologies are out there, we think, to look at things differently.
Hmm. So is it, I'm thinking we're entering a dismal fiscal climate, and it would seem that money for this, for looking for innovation, that's usually one of the first things to go.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what within your department, you're going to have a new commissioner, one would assume, and you're going to have to you're going to have to work on a budget pretty quick. Like the governor's got a budget, and then there will be the legislative process on the budget. I just see this getting one of the first things to get lopped off. Is there a way you can defend it? Is there any way that you could say, well, look, this is how much we're spending now, and this is the projection, because you told me a maintenance situation that's a little scary.
Yeah, exactly. I think the way that you defend it is to explain that, a relatively small investment in research and development really is the only way forward, short of throwing up our hands. We simply don't have enough money available to us from the state and federal government to be able to solve the problem in traditional ways. So if we don't come up with a new way of doing it, then we've got no way forward at all. I think that's the way that you defend it.
So, Jacqueline, you already have social media going on this Kick the Bucket Thrust, right?
Right. I created a Facebook page.
I could go right in on Facebook right now if I had an idea and
Yes. go on Facebook and look up Kick the Bucket, and I look forward to hearing from people with any ideas.
You're throwing all sorts of stuff on there, too,
yeah.
Like all these reports if people want to read them. It's
right.
Pretty
so,
handy that way.
I mean, one of the best ones is a slide presentation that Bill Griffith had posted on the Internet. And I think one of the big eye-openers for me, you know, I went into this kind of thinking, you know, this is one of the wealthiest states in the country. I mean, we've had so much money coming in. Just the other day, an economist at the new governor's transition team conference talked about the $600 million that we've put into four projects. And the state is putting $50 million a year into rural sanitation. So when I first got
and
into
most
this...
Of that's meeting federal matches.
That's
mostly,
right.
Yeah.
Most of them, that's just to meet the federal grants. Well,
yeah.
Bill can add something to that in a minute. So, but let me just say, when I first got into this, I thought, money? We need way more money. But then I looked at, I listened to Bill give a talk at the Arctic Research Commission, and I looked at his slide presentation. And the thing is that in some of these communities, the reason there's no system is because it would just be incredibly expensive. It would cost $500,000 per household to put in the traditional centralized water and sewage treatment facility. And so, as Bill was saying, the only way forward is to go to a new system. And so we have all these aging facilities, and then we have the villages that never had it. And we can't go in with these centralized systems that have to be heated. Everything has to be, the water has to be heated going to the homes. The waste coming out of the homes has to be heated. And then the facility itself has to be heated.
I can just hear some of the engineers in our audience right now, because... You know, whenever it gets to be, oh, it has to be heated, well, then.
Yeah, and the price of
you
oil.
Hook the windmill up to the heat pump. Use the heat pump to use the geothermal energy that's already there. I can hear them now. But it seems we really need this sort of innovation. And we do have a competition. So tell me right now, Bill Griffith, before you talk about the budget, tell me now, how do you, what would a person do if they wanted to get involved with this competition?
Well, at this point, we've got six teams under contract, and we've asked these teams to work with a couple of villages each. So they're already connected with villages that don't have running water and sewer. Those are located really all over the state, but largely in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta and mm-hmm. the interior. And so there are individuals and people in those communities hooked up with those teams already. But as we continue to go forward, we'll be looking for more involvement. And one thing we require these teams to do is to gather feedback on their ideas and local input. Because especially when you talk about a household-based system, it's got to be accepted and supported, obviously, by the end user.
Absolutely. And, you know, the more a home is made into a living entity, the more it requires conscious operation. You know, I mean, you could just... If you have a wood stove, you know there's certain ways you have to treat it or else it's not going to work. You got to clean the chimney and the things you just have to do. You burn certain kinds of wood. And that goes for any kind of system in a household. Mm-hmm. Just a fact. And if there's no culture of that.
Well, you know, it's the thing about visiting. When I visited Kivalina, they have a washateria, and all day, every day, you would see mostly young men carrying, and do you know how much 5 gallons of water weighs?
I
do. It weighs 40 pounds.
I do know.
And so all day you'd see these young men carrying these great big 5 gallon
two
jugs.
Of them. Yeah, 80 pounds, yeah.
Yeah. And walking, you know, there's no vehicle, there's no cars. There are four-wheeler ATVs in Kivalina. And so most people walk or they drive their ATV, but still hefting around 80 pounds of water every day, and that's pretty minimal.
Yeah.
you know, in this, I mean, most of us probably use, what, 100 gallons a day per person in Anchorage?
Well, can be as much as that.
So, and so there's that, hauling the water, and then hauling the honey bucket contents. They have to drive, you know, half a mile or so down to the other, down to the they don't have a sewage lagoon per se. They have kind of an area right in the middle of the dump. That, you know, taking care of a system at home, it seems like if that's what you're used to, as long as it's not too difficult technically, it seems like it would be a lot easier to have to just maintain a system in your house. So
I think this could get really, really interesting. We'll be taking a break in a moment. And also I will say that all of the phone lines are loaded up right now. So obviously this is something a lot of people talk about. What I wanted to get from you, Bill, what the current situation is in terms of federal money and state match and all that that Jocelyn was talking about.
Right. Well, really, the years between 2000 and 2010 were the boom years for funding for rural sanitation. Of course, that coincided with Senator Stevens' time in office. And since 2004, funding has declined by over half. So we're getting less than half the money that we had coming in just 10 years ago. Currently, from all sources, we have about $60 million available to spend. Only about $9 million of that is state funding. And that state funding provided as a requirement for some of the federal money coming in as a match. So we have money coming in from the U.S. EPA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture Rural Development Program, and the Indian Health Service. Those are our federal funding sources. And then, as I say, the state match.
Bill Griffith is with the DEC's Alaska Safe Water Program. And we're talking about honey buckets, village sewer, and water. And we got a lot of calls at 1-800-478-8255. Let's go to Queefluck and Sandy. Welcome to Talk of Alaska. Sandy?
Yeah. This is Sandy. I've been wanting to... Hello?
Hello.
Oh, okay. I've been wanting to make this comment for so long. But, you know, no one's ever approached this subject. You know, why is it when, you know, in the lower 48s, they go like 2 or 3 days without water and sewage services? Then it's declared a national disaster. And then we've been living without water and sewer services for decades. That's my comment. Thank you.
Sandy, thank you so much for chiming in from Queefluck. Let's go to Bob, joins the program from Indian. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Bob.
Hi, Steve. This is Bob Childers. I was curious. In Western Canada, they have a system called, I think they call it pump and dump, but basically it's household water tank and a sewered holding tank, and then there's a pumping truck that services each of the households, and it's, of course, it's been entirely reliable, and it provides some local employment, and I was curious if... you had any information on the economics of this?
Yeah, the old okay, Bob. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, the old honey truck. They sure got a lot of those in Hawaii. You know, with the water table as it is there. That's just kind of the way it's done. And Bill, looks like you know about this.
Yeah, we certainly have those systems up here as well. About a dozen around the state. We typically call them covered haul systems, where water is delivered via a truck or a trailer, and then sewage is hooked up with a different truck and trailer. One of the reasons it works out relatively better in Canada is that they receive a lot of assistance from the federal government to operate those systems. That assistance is not available in this country. They tend to be very expensive per gallon compared to pipe systems. So what we find is that people on those kind of systems in Alaska tend to conserve water to a great extent in order to save money. But then, as a result, they don't realize a lot of the health benefits that go along with running water and sewer.
Bob White out in Yukon Kuskokwim, do you have that system anywhere around? I mean, it seems like it's almost road dependent.
Yeah, well, yes and no. I mean, here in Bethel, that's what we have. And, you know, we have tanker trucks that haul 3,000 gallons delivering water and picking up sewer daily. We have a whole fleet of them here running in Bethel.
Wait a second. That makes an ugly picture in my head, I got to say.
it can be an ugly hardly smell it when they're pumping in your neighborhood. But, you know, my water bill is $375 a month.
Whoa.
For that service. So, yeah, it's quite a bill.
Smaller
communities around operate a smaller system where they're not hauling a 3,000-gallon truck. They're hauling a 150 to 400-gallon trailer behind a four-wheeler, which really limits the amount of water they can effectively deliver. And those costs can be exorbitant to get any real amount of water delivered to a house.
Well, let me ask you this. If you had your choice, I would assume that getting clean water to people would be a higher priority than having a flush toilet.
Yeah, I mean, clean water to people is important. You know, the thing the studies have found is that you need at least 20 gallons of water a day per person to have the health effect.
That's four of those buckets. That young man in the village has to carry four buckets from the washer.
Per person.
Per person. Per day. Yeah, he's probably not all by himself.
He's probably not doing it.
I don't want to be that young man.
And he has to haul them both ways, both to and from the house. You know, getting it there is only half the battle. We have to get it away from the house as well. So.
Yeah. All right. Very good. We're talking to Bob White of Yukon Kuskokwim Health Corporation. And we're getting a wake-up call about village sewer and water as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Alaska Laborers Local 71 and the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities ask you to slow down in construction zones while they work to keep roads safe. Alaska Laborers Local 71, working hard for Alaska. This message is sponsored by Alaska Laborers Local 71.
Going to the ends of the earth on this one. We're talking about village sewer and water here on Talk of Alaska, and looking for ways beyond the honey bucket and maybe beyond the flush toilet. It's been very interesting and great guests, and I want to turn to another member of our panel right now, all the way out at the ends of the earth, at the village of Wales, at the end. What is it? The end of the... It's not the Seward Peninsula, right?
Yeah, it's the tip of the Seward Peninsula. It's the most westerly spot on the continent.
And there we are. And Dan Richards joins us, who is the postmaster there. What's your day like today, Dan, outside of appearing on this show?
Well, not too bad. A little cold, a lot of ice, no snow.
A lot of ice. Well, yeah. So tell me about Wales' situation there with how things work with the... dealing with human waste and water supply.
What we have going here is one of the washout areas like they were talking about, and we have a field line that runs about a half to three-quarters of a mile to a well where we pump it in the summer times and fill a half-million-gallon water tank. And that suffices the village for the winter as far as our washout area where people wash clothes and shower. And then for the... honey bucket system, we have a sewage lagoon, and we have a couple of guys that go around and they pick up these bins that we've got sitting around town that people dump their buckets into, and then they take the bins and haul them out to the sewage lagoon and dump them out there.
That does not sound real sanitary.
The biggest problem here is the sewage lagoon wouldn't be so bad because it's away from town. but everybody uses plastic bags in their buckets because it's one way to make it a little bit cleaner.
Yeah.
But those plastic bags are just clogging up the lagoon, so you're going to wind up with just nothing but a pond.
It seems to me like we ought to have some kind of technical fix on that. It just seems to me that there's some design way of dealing with that.
Well, I would certainly hope so. I'm just starting with this water and sewer challenge thing too, and so we're looking at a few different ideas. But for right now, the biggest problem is no matter what you try to install, you're expecting people out in these villages that really don't have much for income to have to pay for that. And some of that could be upwards of $200 a month just to have take care of your waste. And as right now, we charge $20 a month for using the honey bucket system, and most of them can't even hardly keep up with that.
Yeah, I understand. I would think the cost, I'll turn to Bill Griffith just for an observation on that, but it would mm-hmm. seem like cost is, no matter what you do, the cost is going to be a problem.
Yeah, it's a little surprising that water and sewer is one of the only services in Alaska that's not subsidized. Virtually every other amenity that we have, whether it's electricity or telephone or, let's say, roads, the operation of all of those things is subsidized, but not when it comes to water and sewer. As Dan says, it's completely on the individual homeowners. And another point to bring up is the fact that throughout much of the U.S., typically under 3% of household income goes to paying for water and sewer, oftentimes closer to 1%.
3%, that's insane.
Yeah, but in Alaska villages, that number is typically more than 5% and can even be as high as 10% of household income.
your sewer and water in Anchorage ain't all that great either because they're still paying off those bonds. So it's $100 a household right mm-hmm. there.
And those bonds will continue to come because that system, just like everywhere else, needs improvements.
Yeah. Let's go to Robert, joins the program from Esther. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Robert. Well, what do you say?
Well, thank you, Steve. I've been listening to your program from the beginning, and my brain's kind of exploding here.
Me too.
All the different, if you get your hands around this issue, you will probably win the Nobel Peace Prize.
Right.
But basically, I work for a Fairbanks Town and Village Association early 80s up here and flew all over the Doyon region for Tanana Chiefs and Doyon. And as you are all aware, there's 13 Native corporations, or 12, if you will, in Alaska as far as how it's divided up. And Doyon itself is bigger than Texas. So listening to some of the different comments and having been out to the villages, I can only speak to what I saw in the 80s. And what I did was met with local government and flew to Juneau to lobby for capital funds to build the washeterias, to build the, from the state's perspective, and the sewage lagoons and the what. Part of the, from my perspective, why we are where we are is there's been absolutely, at that period of time, no coordination between the funding sources. And to be quite honest with you, a lot of the legislators back in the 80s attitude was, then, this is way too expensive. We will never be able to afford this. Why doesn't everybody just move into the urban area? I mean, believe it or not, I had legislators actually tell me that, and I was horrified.
I've heard it said myself, yes.
I was horrified by this, and needless to say, that's not going to happen, and it shouldn't. From what I, it's kind of some of the comments I think Jocelyn made kind of remind me of the Pogo cartoon, you know. It's like, I've seen the problem, and the problem is us. Hmm. And basically, there's so many different people had their hands in the pie, and I'm not casting blame here on anybody. It's just the PHS would come out and they'd have a project. The Indian Health Service would come out and they had a project. there was no coordination over what kind of system got built somewhere. So you've got this hodgepodge of everything under the sun. The lowest bidder for the contractor sometimes got picked. Systems got installed for Arizona. And it's just, it goes on and on and on. And I'm sure you folks there at DEC have had to come in and deal with this stuff. And everybody, individual villages, go back to the legislature to get funding to fix some of these systems that should have never been built in the first place.
Yeah.
The other key factor that happened, and I was as guilty as anybody else, I brought this money back, and the legislature at that time refused to fund any money for maintenance. Let's build these things and get these people off our back that are screaming they don't have this or that. There was never any money programmed in for the maintenance of these systems. So, duh. I mean, you know, you've got to maintain your car. You have to maintain everything.
Yep. Well, so, as we heard from Bill earlier, a lot of these systems are at the end of their design life or past it.
And they may have not, probably shouldn't have been built in the first place. So, I mean, as far as the solution to it, and I think there needs to be an overall coordination of, and this may be going on, like I say, my knowledge is quite dated, but there needs to be a combination of technology, the politics, the health and housing and education components all have to be intertwined to solve this problem.
Yeah. Well, I think one thing that Ted Stevens tried to do is set up the Denali Commission, which was supposed to be like the Appalachian Commission, and do some of that coordination function. I think politics kind of intervened in that, unfortunately.
Well, when you get federal money, I was traveling around to these different villages, and I was working on a USDA grant, and I would get these nasty grams from Washington, D.C., saying, hey, why can't you drive or take the bus to Ruby? And they didn't, we actually had a map made up of Alaska superimposed over the United States with the four highways on it.
The bus
so
to Ruby.
You guys would understand that you can't drive to Ruby.
I don't know. If the river's frozen over, couldn't you possibly?
Well, people have done it. But it's basically hit and miss here in the state. Until I started flying around myself, I really had no idea how big it is. And to put your faith and trust into some bureaucracy back in Washington, D.C. is really a crapshoot as far as solving this. And the state, I think, has had this attitude that, hey, if we can get federal money, then we don't have to spend anything. And like you, one of your panel alluded to, the only money that sometimes gets put in it is a match. And I think the state has completely dropped the ball with rural Alaska as far as solving some real problems. And I believe, this is a speculation, I think there's an attitude with some urban legislators out of sight, out of mind. This isn't my district. I don't have to worry about this.
Or that, let Lyman take care of it.
Yeah, and back in the day, in the 80s, there were some rural...
Al Adams, Frank Ferguson, yeah, you bet.
Because
John Sackett, they used to...
Honest, with the Fairbanks in the rural caucus,
yeah.
Merged together in order to have some political power with Anchorage.
Yeah.
Where three-quarters of the population lives. Where do you think the money's going to go?
Yeah. Robert, thanks for that.
Thank you.
That was a great overview there. And, it was kind of, you didn't, Bill Griffith, you sat there very, very politely.
Well, he makes some very good points, and a lot of that is still true. We certainly only do provide the required match here. I think we have come a long way in terms of coordination, but what he said about what was going on in the 80s is true as well. But the federal and state programs work together pretty closely now, along with tribal programs like Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. So I think that the coordination has improved, but it takes a lot more than that to solve the problem.
And I think that what Robert said about the attitude that why don't people just move their villages? Why don't they just leave their villages and move somewhere else?
Yeah.
I mean, until you go to one of these places and see the, you know, these are communities. They have a school and homes, and everybody knows everything. Everybody, they're very tight-knit. It's a wonderful place to live. It's beautiful in a lot of these villages. And so I would never say, and we need people in rural Alaska. I mean, you know, I heard Admiral Papp, who's I forget what his title is, but he's a U.S. Coast Guard admiral.
A new job, yeah.
Yeah, and he's got a new job having to do with the Arctic. Right. And he said he's looking for an idea that will inspire Americans to deal with the Arctic the same way that we sent a man to the moon and that we've had these other enormous breakthroughs. He was looking for something that would inspire people to deal with the Arctic. And I think Alaskans need something like that. I mean, you know, aside from the problems of not having, I mean, the reason there's not enough money is because there's not the will. And I think if you go to a village and you talk to people and you find out about babies whose lungs and bronchial tubes are scarred because they caught RSV or pneumonia or something like that. I mean, infectious disease rates go way up when people don't have enough water. And I lived in a cabin one time. You know, you get a little wash basin, you fill it up with water, and all day long you wash your hands in the wash basin.
Everything you can with that water, you betcha.
Yeah, and if you have a lot of people in the house and everybody's using the same wash basin, you know, the germs, the towel, everything like that.
No matter how hard you try.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so there's a human cost. And that those diseases come into the larger communities. So I think it's an issue that it can be resolved, it can be solved, but it takes will. And I'm not sure that the will is here in Alaska right now.
Well, really nice Crystal chiming in, a student of rural development, master's degree student, and she was just fascinated by this, and she's scolding me for saying, look, you think it's hand-wringing, but we really need to be talking about this stuff. And he goes, okay, I'll take that. But she also says, can you answer the question about why we don't get federal disaster declarations in Alaska? Well, I can answer that question. Congress made sure that disaster declarations are extremely restricted. They did that. The legislature hasn't been much help on that either. So that's the answer for that. And then this other one, resources like water and sources of energy are finite and at some point will become emergent for larger populations. Do you feel that in solving problems and addressing basic infrastructure and health sanitation needs, we are trying to catch up to where people in urban areas already are, or are we trying to get ahead of the game and innovate? We would like to be innovators, wouldn't we? I think that's more of a rhetorical question as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Winter is a time to focus on home and family, a time for eating good food and telling stories. This season, the Salmon Project is thankful to be sharing Alaskan salmon stories from around the state. The Salmon Project celebrates Alaskans' deep personal relationships with salmon as food, a source of pride, a way of life, and as the focus of a lot of fun. To read Alaskan stories or share your own, visit salmonproject.org/story. Salmon, it runs deep in all of us. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
It's Talk of Alaska. We're talking about village sewer and water, and Dan Richards is with us by telephone from Wales, where he's the postmaster. Just wanted to ask you for any concluding observations there, Dan.
Well, one thing I'd like to say is thank you for having me on here, but I don't think that this problem is a matter of money. I think the problem is a matter of research. We need to start looking more at nature and less in our back pocket, because no matter how much money you sink into these projects, yeah, they might work for a while, but you're expecting people out here to maintain them. And, you know, that's kind of like putting high-tech in a low-tech society. It just doesn't, it's never going to really work that way.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, how about the Washateria? How's that working out?
Well, it's not too bad. It's probably the only moneymaker we have in a village. I'm the mayor here, too.
The mayor and the postmaster. Are you on the school board,
pretty
too?
Pretty much covers our... No, I'm on the hospital board.
Oh, okay.
So, but yeah, I mean, it's not bad, but it does require an awful lot of maintenance. And we're in the process right now of trying to build a new one, and so that gets into another whole book of problems. But no matter what you do out here, we need to start looking at nature and less in our back pockets. I think there's other ways of going about this that are much easier to maintain.
Well, hopefully we can talk radio can facilitate some of that. I sure hope. So thanks for joining us, Dan.
Thank you very much for having me.
From out there in Wales. You don't have to get off the phone, but I just wanted to conclude the conversation here because we're running out of time. And we got, as I said, the phone lines are jammed up. Dolly in Caltag, welcome to Talk of Alaska. Dolly in Caltag, can we say goodbye to Dolly? Dolly, you coming to the phone? Okay. We'll move on to Ingrid then in Kachemak Bay. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Ingrid.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
It's pretty simple. It's not rocket science. You don't crap in your water.
Well, of course.
What you do is you crap in the land because the earth can turn those nutrients and all that waste into fertilizer and feed the planet.
Well, that is true. Did you hear our show with Mark Nelson?
I don't know, but I got
to
say one thing. It's totally jingoistic and hypocritical for us to lecture to the bush. I do live in the bush, but for Anchorage to lecture to the bush on sanitation with what they're doing to Cook Inlet, dumping all that sewage into Cook Inlet to the point it's driving the beluga whales extinct. It's just a bigger version of the honey bucket.
Ingrid, Ingrid,
yeah.
Hang on here. Just, I wanted to say, factually, you can't back that up very well. That's all
yes,
I'm saying.
Yes, I can. I did a whole story on it a few years ago. I don't have the statistics in front of me, but they were checked right through to the EPA and DEC.
You cannot make a direct cause and effect relationship between the decline of the beluga whale. Listen to me. Between the decline of the beluga
like
whales and
now,
the dumping
back.
of the effluent from the Anchorage
let's
wastewater.
On,
get rid of her, will you please? One thing I can't stand is somebody that's just got some kind of environmental hobby horse to take advantage of this program with misinformation. Let's go to Eva, joins the program from Fairbanks. Hi, Eva.
Hi. I'm sorry. I don't quite have my radio off yet.
Well, do you want to walk over there and turn it off? We'll all listen to you walking
there we go.
Over. Okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
Well, I myself live in a home just outside of Fairbanks, and not because I had to, but because I chose to, I decided to put in a composting toilet inside the house. Well, the composting toilet works by separating the two streams. So you collect the solids.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me that you could develop a system like that where, again, you would encourage economic development by having a truck or whatever that collected the solids and the liquids separately. And you could, you know, the solids are already pretty close to compost. And then you turn it into a community garden.
So you could have so you could have a more than one stage, you're saying, of treatment. You could have one treatment at the home and then we're just partially treated, could be moved to another location.
Well, you know, the solid container is only so big.
Right, I know.
Because of our colder temperatures, it may not have completely turned to compost.
Oh, yeah, I know. The cold temperatures, yeah. I think, you know, when we get to the real design level on some of these systems that don't use water, cold temperature is going to be a real problem. You know, Mark Nelson was talking about it, the wastewater garden guy. He says, I just don't know in northern climates. I just don't know. The colder it is, the slower the processes are going to go.
These are much more sanitary in the way they're designed than, you know, the honey bucket with just a seat on a bucket type of system. And, you know, easy to clean and keep clean. And, you know, there's no odor at all inside the house. And they can be operated without electricity. There's a little fan, but it's designed for DC, not AC. You just have a transformer kit you buy to convert it to AC, so it can work off-grid or on-grid.
Oh,
and
great.
They're just really handy. But I was thinking, you know, you could use that concept and just develop it into a greater scale.
All right.
For a small community.
Eva, thanks. Bill, you're nodding your head.
Well, absolutely. It's systems like that that we want to take a look at. That's an example of a household toilet system that might hold some promise. And what we want to do is kind of put that together with some approaches on the water side and see what we can come up with.
Now let's go down. Stay on there, Eva. I might try and pull you back into the conversation here, but I want to go to Keith in Anchorage. You still with us, Keith?
I am.
Okay.
And you've already touched on a great deal of what I'm afraid I don't have any solutions. You talked a lot about the budget problem involved in all of this. If I'm thinking that a large native population has lived out in the bush for a number of generations. What did their ancestors do for this problem before modern conveniences came along?
Well, actually, I think that's a fairly easily answered question because, it's pretty well acknowledged that there were a bunch of things that happened in the process of contact that created the situation of villages as we have them now. Nomadic people would have just
right.
used the land and it really wouldn't have been a problem. I want to go back to Eva for a second. Eva in Fairbanks, you still with me?
Yes.
Yeah, this business of separating, what do you do with the liquid side of it?
Well, I actually just kind of sprinkle it about in the woods as long as, and it kind of goes back to what the other caller was saying. You know, people used to live with
more space. I got another question, though. How do you, mechanically, how does this work?
Oh, I'm sorry. you lift up the toilet. The toilet actually mm-hmm. takes up less space than a conventional toilet because there's uh-huh. no sink. And there's two little clips that keep it sealed shut. You just undo the clips, you lift the toilet just a few inches, and there's a handle on the tank. You quickly put a cap on the tank.
Uh-huh.
That's the only time you experience any odor.
Okay. We're out of time. What an adventure. I want to thank everybody for participating. Jocelyn, thanks for bringing up this idea.
Mm-hmm, my pleasure
to be here. We'll take it up again. Thank you so much, Bill Griffith of DEC. Yeah. And thanks to Dave Waldron, Josh Edge, Ashley Snyder. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. You've heard of Black Friday, Small Business Saturday, and Cyber Monday. Well, now you're hearing about Giving Tuesday, a day to kick off the season of giving back on Tuesday, December the 2nd. Celebrate the season of giving with Alaska Public Media and the Alaska Community Foundation on Tuesday, December the 2nd by giving a gift to the cause you care about most. When you live and give in Alaska, you make a real difference in your home community.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.